Uplus AI is pleased to present a podcast series on healthcare and AI. In this season, the focus is on doctors. I meet doctors to get their on-the-ground perspective of healthcare, understand challenges, and we explore together where artificial intelligence may provide the best outcomes for all. I am Ranga, creator and host of the Uplus AI podcast and the human face of Uplus AI in Twitter, SoundCloud, YouTube, and Medium. I have a background in engineering, and I've been a technologist in the networking domain for more than a decade, working on switches and routers, packets and buffers, wired and wireless. If you'd like to know more about me, go to LinkedIn and search for Ranga Prasad Sampath. I am passionate about artificial intelligence, and this podcast is my effort to bring awareness on both sides. That is, for technologists like me to know the problems on the ground in healthcare, and for medical practitioners to know where AI may intervene to drive the best outcomes for all. Hello and welcome, everyone. In this episode, it's my honor to meet with Dr. P.V. Vijayaraghavan. He is the Vice Chancellor of the Sri Ramachandra Institute of Higher Education and Research in Chennai. Dr. Vijayaraghavan has had over 30 years of experience as a practicing orthopedic surgeon in various capacities in teaching and non-teaching hospitals. He has had special interest in joint replacement surgeries and has undergone several special trainings in this specific field. He has a keen interest in medical healthcare and medical education. In his current role, he is the chairman of several policy-making bodies relevant to medical education in the Sri Ramachandra Deemed University. It is an honor to welcome Dr. P.V. Vijayaraghavan to this show. Welcome, sir.
Thank you, Prasad, for this opportunity.
Yes, we'll be, I'm sure we have a lot of interesting topics to talk about, Doctor. So let's get started.
Yeah.
Doctor, could you briefly outline the structure of medical education in India since, you've been especially associated with it in your past as well as your current role?
Yeah. The medical education in India at the graduate level, it actually aims to create professionals of primary contact. That means they should be able to deliver healthcare to the society at large at the primary level. They must have the knowledge, the skills, attitude, values, and responsiveness towards caring for the people and the society. Normally, the undergraduate education in India, the MBBS program, runs for about 4.5 years and 1 year of internship training. Once they complete this, then they are called a basic medical doctor, and that's the basic requirement for somebody to practice medicine in India. Then if they want to do a postgraduate education, their choice is there. Some people can stop short at the MBBS level itself and go into practice. Mm-hmm. There are a group of people who would want to specialize further in postgraduate education. And there are almost about 73 different postgraduate specialty branches that they can specialize in various subjects. Mm-hmm. That is a 3-year program. Many of the foreign countries, this particular training runs for even 5 years and 6 years. But in India, we have kept the training only for about 3 years. And once they sort of complete this, there may be some people who may want to go and do a super specialization. Mm-hmm. Maybe at the level of a DM or an MCH. And these also are possible in super specialties like cardiology, neurology, nephrology, and things like that. Apart from this, if they don't want to do a full-fledged DM or an MCH program, there is also a possibility of doing fellowship programs in recognized medical centers for the training that they receive in certain specialized areas. Mm-hmm. Like the fellowship program in critical care, the fellowship program in infectious diseases. So these are some of the possibilities. But if you ask me, what is the big difference between how I studied and how people would like to study now? There is a vast difference. Now, presently, the traditional mode over the last 50 to 60 years, we have actually followed the Flexner's theory of education, which is mostly didactic, is one-sided. It is mostly knowledge-centric, a lot of information gathering. It is discipline-based, doesn't allow too much of integration. Of course, for medicine, hospital-based, because we have to learn on the patients, whatever we see. But is it all right with patient safety? Questionable. So that is something. And there are uniform electives. That is, student really doesn't have a choice of electives. He is just told to take amongst three or four subjects which he has to choose from. And it usually follows an apprenticeship model where he sort of chooses a mentor and works with him and things like that. This has stood the test of time. If you ask me what is wrong, am I not a good doctor? The answer is no. Mm-hmm. Invariably, many of us who have done the traditional type of learning have learned it. But the basic difference is that previously, we were put in the swimming pool, whether you knew swimming or not. Mm-hmm. And 90% of them might just come out of it somehow or the other. But there will be definitely one or two people who might drown and who may not come out that successfully. From that type of, we actually observed quite a lot of gaps in the training. Mm-hmm. Because at the end of the day, theoretical bookish knowledge of what you learn in the books may not allow you the skill to actually treat a patient. So this mm-hmm. was a huge gap between healthcare delivery and the education that you received. And most of us learned after we qualified. After we qualified, when we saw a patient, right. obviously we'll have to go and refer and then find out what is the best. But it's not the best of the models. So we turned towards how this can be changed. So if you look at that development, in 1997, India came up with the medical regulations for medical mm-hmm. education. The first was done in 1981. And for 16 years, there was not much scope for improvement. It was completely didactic and discipline-based. Okay. But in 1997, the principle of integration was brought in. And mm-hmm. in every subject, they were told that you have to look at how best you can integrate between basic science and clinical science as they apply.
I see.
This changed the scenario to a great extent. So the SPICES model is what they talk about in the West when they do this. It is student-centric from being teacher-centric earlier. Mm-hmm. It is problem-based. So you have to see a patient, make a diagnosis, and then learn from there the basic aspects about it. It is integrated. It is community-based. See, at the end of the day, most medical colleges today in India are attached to tertiary care hospitals. The care in a tertiary care for an MBBS level is too high. So they should be more and more going to the community-based learning. And the very few institutions like CMC Vellore actually provides for that type of community-based learning.
And when you talk about tertiary care, you're talking about super specialized, which is why you're saying
exactly.
that the level of care is very high.
Okay. Exactly. Like they see complex cases. They do not see the run-of-the-mill, straightforward things.
I see.
But that is the way we have. So now we are looking at all these changes. And we are now even telling that every medical college should actually run a rural health center very close by. Mm-hmm. And that is a place where most of these MBBS students should be posted and they should learn. Mm-hmm. So that was a basic error in the whole concept what had been envisaged earlier on. Mm-hmm. So these are the basic differences in the models that are there. Now after that, since 1997, again there was a lull, a lot of thinking happened, and the medical council actually looked at what was the success of the 1997 changes. The basic difference was the paper document on the regulations was existing. Mm-hmm. But all this was circulated to the dean's office and who was keeping it under lock and key and never went to the faculty at large. So ultimately, unless the faculty is developed towards these changes, you can't see the change in the curriculum in a very, very big way. And this was realized by the medical council. And I'm happy to say that since 2009, I've been an active expert member of this group in the medical council and regularly interacting with them. And we felt the first step should be towards making our faculty sort of comply with many of the modern educational technologies. Because if you have to make this student-oriented, you must allow more chances for the students to interact, more chances for the students to ask questions, and more chances for the students to actually experience simulated type of learning before they actually go on to the actual patient type of learning. I'll tell you the highlights of the present model. It's only 1 year, so it's too early to say whether the outcome is going to be perfectly all right or not. But what it calculates is, first 2 months, the students go into a foundation course. During our time, Prasad, actually the first 3 days I had heavy fever. Because the first thing in a medical college that we saw was a dead body. Although you are supposed to be treating live patients and making them all right, the first exposure was in anatomy to go and meet with the dead body. So that, you know, people at that young age, 17 years and all, would definitely be quite a different experience. So that we have changed. Now we have got them to learn the basic foundation course, which allows them to learn about basic life support. In South Korea, if, for example, if you see, even a common man on the roadside can resuscitate a person if he collapses. But in India, even an educated cardiologist sometimes may not be able to do it. So that we identified as a huge gap. And this is an important component that has been included as early as the first week of their posting in MBBS. So similarly, we included, and as you were asking and talking earlier, some theoretical learning of health policies on infection control practices, on alternative systems of medicine. One of the big drawbacks in the allopathic system is that the doctors of allopathic medicine really do not think that other medicines really work. Ayurveda or Siddha and other things, they really don't think. And they can't even refer a patient when it is required. And even when he fails for nearly 10 years, 12 years, he doesn't think that there is a chance for doing. So there is a possibility for him to know all these aspects and language training, because people can come from north and study in south. So they must know the local language. So all these aspects are sort of covered in the first 2 months of their training in the MBBS.
It's good to hear that, doctor, because, you know, typically I have not come across many allopathic doctors who really believe in Ayurveda or homeopathy or even consider them as systems of medicine. So if there is an effort to actually integrate them, I think that would be very good. There's something that, you know, may, probably very unique in India that, you know, that can give some benefits.
This is exactly what we are working on right now. Then the other concept that has been introduced in the new curriculum is the early clinical exposure. That is, even as early as the first 1 month of their posting, they will go into the hospital to see some of the common areas, how exactly counseling happens, how exactly registration happens, how exactly injections are given. They may not do the procedure, but they will observe quite a lot of.
So when you say early, so how early is this? Is it like a
first year?
Oh, okay, year of their MBBS. Called,
see, by definition, early clinical exposure is in the first year. Previously, we were actually during our time, I saw the first abscess drainage in my internship. I have never seen it before. So that was the case. That is almost 4.5 years afterwards. But today, the student has a chance even to see how an echocardiogram is done, how a treadmill is being used. So there is a lot of possibility for them to learn it differently. And experiential learning. We are using many of the modern methods of allowing reflective learning, experiential learning. So these type of things are really making the student, hopefully, that they will appreciate that those people will become better doctors for the future.
Yeah, I was about to ask you, doctor, that, you know, whether it be in technology, like me in engineering or in medicine, you know, one of the things that you sometimes hear from students is, oh, yeah, we go to classes, we have labs, but, you know, sometimes there is this thing that, you know, it's not very engaging or it is not, does not make it very immersive for them. you know, yes, some of the students will definitely, you know, as you say, many students will learn to swim, many students will, you know, absorb it. But for the average student or for many of the people, they don't find it engaging enough. So are some of these things done so that the engagement can be higher? And if the engage, if there's an engaged student, obviously he'll learn better. He will be an asset to the community as well.
Absolutely. You hit the nail on its head. Now, this is exactly the present focus that we are doing. Now, we have introduced Moodle platform. I'm sure you are aware of the massive online platform that is providing actually quite a lot of space for almost a lot of things to be provided free of cost. Mm-hmm. Now, all our first clinical and preclinical and paraclinical subjects, right up to pharmacology from anatomy, they are all taught through this platform. Mm-hmm. Of course, the didactic sessions are in the form of the PowerPoint slides are shared with the students much earlier. They are told what is the session that is going to happen. Mm-hmm. So majority of times, the teachers, when they come, they just put the slides for them to revise what they had learned. And the students are actually asked to ask questions. And we have quite a lot of, smaller game plans within the class where pair share is one of the things. Two students just join up, talk about a particular concept, and then they open it up for another two students. So this is something. Then we also have the automated response system. Like, you know, once you have taken a session and they have learned certain things, you can post questions and assignments online. Okay. And that the students, once they answer, at the end of it, the computer will tell you 65% of them answered it rightly. Mm. So once they say that, you know that still you have missed out on 35%. So you can easily do some corrective action on people who had probably not got the concept right. So these are some of the things that normal medical colleges in India are still struggling to introduce. Luckily, Ramachandra has always given importance to all these things, and we are able to sort of induct these type of principles into the learning ambience. See, even our regular education should rather be concentrating, but that's a long dream for me, that is not going to happen overnight, should not be so much discipline-based, on certain syllabus, table of contents and things like that. It should be more on practical applications as what you are going to see on the ground. There can be apps that can develop for, say, making a diagnosis of a myocardial infarction. Mm-hmm. And based on that, they should work out what exactly happens to the cardiac muscle, how exactly the ECG abnormalities are seen, how the echo will show, and if necessary, what an angiogram will show. These type of things is what I think people will understand. And these are the common things that are required. But the system that we presently have is there will be a didactic lecture on heart as a pump. Mm-hmm. And, you know, all the four chambers, how many muscles are made. They are relevant. I'm not saying for one moment they are not relevant, but the connect is lost. People really don't know why they particularly learned this. So that is the main force that we need to work on.
True.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, the other media that we have also started, platforms that we have started using, are the Google Classroom, which actually allows for live classes to be taken. Now, particularly with COVID, it has taught us quite a lot of the silver lining of all this crisis has been that the entire education is online now. People in the past would have insisted for presence of students on the ground, but now everybody is doing it in their own house. And everything is happening through many of these present models that are available. See, unfortunately, this I have to tell you, Coursera, personally, I have interacted with this group for quite some time. Mm-hmm. It is very useful for engineering, but somehow the healthcare component there is lacking. But this is where I'm actually requesting them to work with Ramachandra and develop a lot of content matter for medical education and healthcare education, health professional.
That'll be good. Yeah. I can totally attest to they being very good in engineering. In fact, one of the, you know, sort of the bridge between the two, right? So we are also talking about artificial intelligence in medicine. In fact, they've launched a new specialization called artificial intelligence in medicine. It's a 3-course specialization. But again, it's focused on medical data part, like, you know, getting x-rays and scans and everything, and then using it in engineering means to arrive at interpretations. right? So, for example, can you diagnose from an X-ray whether a fracture has been there? Can you diagnose from just X-rays whether there is a pulmonary ailment or not? So those kind of exercises and all, I think they've started with, but I think definitely, I think we will see more.
Yeah, I think the future is for AI in healthcare. That is the future, whether we like it or not. Because this is why I keep telling, I had the opportunity to visit Georgia Tech. And in Georgia Tech, while the engineering institution is huge, just opposite is the Emory. So you see that type of connect is, that is the type of connect that is really required. And I must inform you that Ramachandra at our place has also introduced an engineering college, which is concentrating on all these aspects. And it's very close within the same campus of the medical college and the medical institution. So that type of interactivity is what is mostly required.
Yeah, that's right, doctor. Because see, what as technologists, we would like to know is, what are the problems in medical care that we need to solve? And especially, for example, if we are in India, we want to know what are the problems that are close at heart to Indian society, Indian people, where we can solve problems. That is from the technology side. I think from the medical side, I think it will be good for you guys to know how technology can help. Oh, can it help with computer vision? Can it help with language translation? Can it help with delivering courses massively online? And can it bring a teaching platform to you? So I think what you said about the connect is so relevant, because if these two can collaborate, I think we can create very powerful solutions for our own communities and our own country.
Yeah, one primary area that I want all engineers to look at, or the AI specialists to look at, is pattern recognition. Mm-hmm. You know, every disease has got some pathognomonic features, either in symptomatology or in the signs, to make a diagnosis. So if there is some sort of an AI tool, software that is available, because today the doctor is spending a lot of time looking at images alone. So there is not much importance given to actual physical examination. Mm-hmm. It is fine, because physical examination in all its goodness still can only get a diagnosis, an accurate diagnosis of 54% sensitivity. Mm-hmm. It is not a very high this thing. But once you sort of combine this with investigations, you can be almost 90-95% accurate in your diagnosis. Mm-hmm. So with that in mind, if there is any software tool that sort of puts up, there are some, like if you say headache, obviously that will be a drop-down menu, which will come and say whether it's a neurological disorder, a simple headache, it's a vascular headache, all those things are there. But a little more work on that in terms of exactly what is the diagnosis that can be achieved purely on these grounds is something, is an area which we can really develop. So the other area, even in education, I think simulator-based education, I think AI has a huge role to play, because we have to create for the student virtual ERs, emergency room, virtual operating rooms, virtual labor room, where, you know, with mannequins and things like that, which are computerized, they should be able to sort of get a lot of training beforehand. It is developed fairly well. I won't say it is still, I should probably say that it's halfway through in terms of many possibilities. And we can actually alter on the computer some of the virtual scenarios that an emergency patient will be going through, and then we can allow the students to interpret over a period of time. But there is a scope for improvement in all those areas as well.
And I wanted to ask you, since you brought up the simulations, see, even I've heard, even in when you guys teach classes of anatomy, you need actual cadavers, right? And there may be a shortage of cadavers. Not everybody can get a body to kind of understand, dissect, and all that. So, so do you find that even in such cases, these kind of approaches will be helpful?
Absolutely. I have, in fact, seen one model of what they call Anatomarch or something like that. Some company has come up. But only problem, Prasad, in all these things is that the feel that you are supposed to get while dissecting or while operating, generally, I think the computer technology is not able to reproduce.
Give that. Okay.
This is that is only one small area which I think they will have to improve upon. Otherwise, every plane, you can go through dissection, skin, subcutaneous tissue, muscle, vessels, nerves, everything mm-hmm. is so beautifully brought out. You don't need a cadaver. That, mm-hmm. to that extent, things have developed. So, but that is only one drawback is sometimes people use it as a play tool, like a game. Mm-hmm. So then right. sometimes the seriousness is lost. So that is the only concern. But that's a huge area that we can also work on.
And how about surgeries, doctor? Because I've seen a report where a team of doctors, I think in the UK, performed using virtual reality, sort of reconstruct the anatomy of the person, and they were able to go through a simulation session first and then had virtual reality assist them in actually doing the surgery. So somewhere like...
Absolutely.
So that kind of, makes it clear for people. And you also talked about, holding live classes, but how about live surgeries? When a doctor is actually performing, how can students see that and learn from it? And that too in a bigger scale.
Yeah, this is where I must mention two or three developments. One is the robotic surgery. I am 100% sure computer-based robotic surgery is what is the present trend, which a lot of specialists are actually practicing. Mm-hmm. And that has a lot of AI applications for it to actually perform live surgeries. That is, live surgeries being using computer-based or navigation-based or robotic-based this thing. But the other aspect is that when you do live surgery, there is also possibility for, to stop a lot of medical errors from happening. See, because in navigation, that's the biggest advantage that, when you go near a vessel, there'll be a bleep, which will say, don't go there. So that type of help, you can't get it with just, of course, a lot of us do it with our experience, but computer will always be more precise and they will tell you. The second area is my own orthopedic field. There are patient-specific implants. By 3D printing technology, you can actually get the patient's CT scan molded into what will be the requirement of the prosthesis before the surgery itself, that you don't have to have a huge implant sort of registry in the theater. You can just plan this entire thing, and majority of times that implant which you have actually selected will fit to the patient 100%. It is a la carte. It is not that, for a size 3, you have adjusted and put a 2.5 and things like that.
It is custom made. It is very personalized to that patient.
And the concept is called patient-specific implant generation. A PSI is what we call. So there is a lot of scope there. Then even the field of neurosurgery, stereotactic, and even in the case of oncological surgery, there is a lot of scope for AI application in a real terms. That is, during the surgery itself, it will be of great help. Of course, there are some learning curves that people will have to undergo the training and then use it for patients. It's absolutely patient safety improves. There is no doubt. And enough literature is available to say that is the way forward. Some traditionalists might say, no, my hand can do, and I have a 3D image of the whole thing in my mind, I'll do it. That's what they will argue. And they may be right, because they would be all right on 99 cases, but one case would have really hit them hard.
I mean, that's an interesting point, doctor. Maybe I want to touch upon that a little bit. As you said, there are always traditionalists, they would say that, why should I use this? I mean, what really, I mean, I have experience, I've done so many surgeries. So there is always this, sort of a pressure, counter pressure to using technology and say that, hey, we really don't need that, right? So what would you tell your fellow physicians who are, or your faculty in your own institution, sometimes when you face that counter pressure of, let's not go down this path because of whatever reason?
See, this is where, you asked an excellent question, and I would tell you this is where evidence-based medicine really comes into play. Mm-hmm. Now, the traditionalists are usually, after experience, they would be 50-55. Around that time, probably they are not, their mindset is not tuned towards too many changes, because a total knee replacement, just as an example I'm telling you, for an experienced surgeon might take you only 30 minutes. Mm-hmm. And if they have to go for a different technique and then with all this navigation, and it may take you 1.5 hours to 2 hours. Mm. And the learning curve is, so time is precious and time is money as well. Mm. So many of these people, they would not encourage or embrace any of these newer techniques because of that reason. They may not tell you out like that. That may be, but the way forward, in my opinion, is youngsters who are just about 4 years, 5 years into training in a specialty, and they are already also fairly savvy with the computer technology and things like that. Mm-hmm. They are the people who must be encouraged. When we do something, we tend to overdo the whole thing. Mm-hmm. And see, like a straightforward appendicectomy or a herniorrhaphy, why somebody should struggle and then invent something when the outcomes are quite already even otherwise. So for anything where the outcome is not more than 94-95%, you look at some alternatives. But if it is giving 95% outcomes positive and successes, I think we should still stay back with that. So that is what,
So you're saying basically focus where the help is more most required.
Correct.
Where it will be most beneficial.
Exactly. So I was so amazed. See, again, I'm telling you about the Georgia Tech. The engineer there, I don't know, I forget his name. I think it's some Guru Prasad or somebody. Now, this person, he's in the engineering section. Every day he used to go to the cardiothoracic theater. And there he was watching whatever all the difficulties that the surgeon was facing. And today he has created a bypass of a material that is exactly simulating the material of the normal artery.
So, I see.
see, that is how, you know, otherwise if I stay back with my own, I will be happy with what I am doing. Sure. And he will be happy with what he is producing. And he showed me all those beautiful bypass arteries that he had created in his own lab. So, this is what is the true marriage that is required between the engineers and,
That's a lovely example. I'm sure our audience would be thrilled to hear that. And I think towards that only is what we are doing is an effort to basically bring, you know, medical doctors like you, experienced doctors like you and technologists so that there is a good marriage and, you know, something interesting can be developed from that. So, doctor, I want to ask you, I think you spoke very well about what are the kind of things that you're doing in undergraduate education to improve the engagement of students and the technology assist that you're having, as well as what is your message to faculty to adopt more, you know, technology where it is needed. So there is also this concept of digital health, right? Digital health. In fact, Dr. Bertalan Mishko, who looks at the future of medicine, talks of digital health as being a cultural transformation. So how do you see this in the people that you interact with, whether it's faculty, whether it's students, whether it's administrators, whether it's policymakers? And I think you interact with a broad spectrum of these people. How do you see their opinion about digital health and how we are moving forward with it?
This is there's a huge scope. These are early stages in India about digital health. Many hospitals have not even gone in for the emergency, the electronic medical records. Even the electronic medical records are just about beginning to happen. Now, the important thing here is it's an excellent thing for getting history taking, you know, getting the details from the patients. It is also very nice to get all investigations reviewed from anywhere, and they all can be through digital health. The component that is really missing out and we need to really look at is the factors of empathy, sympathy for the patient and other aspects like, you know, even clinical assessment. These are sometimes very difficult under the digital platform. So this is where I think some sort of a marriage has to happen, which can sort of fill in. Because at the end of the day, the patient, they are now accepting a lot of things. They actually, when they come in, they just show out quite a lot of MRIs and other investigations to the doctor, even before they want him to actually examine him. But at the end of it, if you ask a lot of patients in terms of feedback, patient expectation is more and more towards communication from the doctor. This can happen on digital. It can happen on digital, absolutely, fantastically. But then you would find that there is always a gap where that touch, the human touch from the doctor is going to also make a difference. So other than that, I think digital health will be the future. Like already you said, everybody carries a smartphone where all his health data is completely stored. And any point in time, even if he walks 10 steps more, it can be recorded. Even if he has to run 2 miles, that is recorded. So there is a lot of scope here, but I think we have to take measured steps in terms of providing this.
No, I think your point is right, because digital health, what I meant is digital health can be probably used to, like you said, maybe understand the patient better.
Correct.
Such that it frees up more time for the doctor to engage with him with empathy. You know, instead, see, sometimes what happens, I've heard from some of the doctors is, in the conversation itself, many things about the data and everything may be missed because, you know, in India, there are so many patients. A doctor has to attend to so many patients that you only have certain amount of time. And in that time, you get a certain amount of data about the patient, about their current illness, the medical history and all that. But if a complete data repository was available, perhaps it allows the doctor to focus on the important parts and then reserve the rest of the time to talk to the patient, maybe for the human touch, for the compassion, for the empathy.
Yeah, you are absolutely right. That's and the other one area of digital health which we must data analytics. Mm-hmm. From the point of data analytics, I think digital health is the word way to go forward, because just by feeding into the computer, you can now let me know what is the actually it's already happening in COVID, as you can see on a daily basis. What is the rate of growth? What is the number of deaths that are happening? All these things are very, very, at a click of a button, you can easily get to these data. And also, where ICU facilities that you are looking at, a lot of these computer data can be connected for a doctor to be sitting at home or from anywhere and advising even distant. You know, quite a lot of this telemedicine and everything can happen through digital health rather than through through the platform of actually contacting the patient and looking at the patient. So there is a lot of scope.
So doctor, continuing further, I wanted to ask, now we talked about so many AI applications in medicine, right? I mean, be it medical image interpretation or health risk, or you talked about 3D printing of implants and all that. So see, sometimes your AI applications will give you a result saying, you know, for example, if you show a X-ray image, it may say that the probability of fracture is 73%. And probability of a lesion, or, you know, probability of a tumor being malignant is, let's say, 63%. Or it may give, the output is in these engineering terms or mathematical terms. So how do you think doctors will be equipped to kind of convey this to the patients? Like, what do you think they... Or should they be exposed to more of these apps which will make them proficient? Or is there something that you think should change in the curriculum? Maybe, I mean, it's a funny question to ask, but do you think more mathematics and probability is coming into the medical education?
It is coming. Evidence-based is all like that. You know, if you ask me, I've been practicing for 35 years. I will never tell a patient just percentage-wise like that. I would say, I know that... If you undergo a total hip replacement out of 100, I know one of you could get infected. That is the literature that is supported. But I would also tell them, see, I would expect that you would be in the 99. That's what I pray, and I would thrive for that. But the one which fails due to infection, it is 100% failure for you. You understand? So you have to make the patient understand in his language. So these, all these statistical details and other things that are there, the exact mathematical language of the computer may not be very useful for the patient. They they may not appreciate it also.
Exactly.
But as long as you can get that data and then convert that into colloquial local terms and then tell them, they invariably accept that. But that is the way forward. There is no escaping that type of a that type of an approach in the modern medicine. Now, this is a huge area of gap that we are not at all addressing in medical education. This is where I think now, see, bioinformatics has come in a small way. Now only we are offering that as a electives, as an elective for 2 months for the MBBS student to go through. But I do not know whether he will have sufficient interaction to know what exactly is required. But to my mind, almost every student should learn basic technology at least for to some extent to understand many of these terms what I am using right now. Mm-hmm. I have learned because of my interest in medical education. If you ask a standard normal doctor, they will be seeing skies in terms of what they've understood.
That's true.
This is a huge gap. I think that you addressed it actually in your one of the queries that you raised, that I think there should be chapters almost in every subject in terms of evidence-based and digital health as a concept. Mm. As a concept, people should be able to understand how I can use the digital world for my own specialty, or how I can. So something to that extent, once it works out, I think that will be a great contribution towards medical education.
Yeah, one example, doctor, is, you know, I was speaking to a diabetologist and she was telling me that, you know, one of the patients can come in and, you know, they have an app, you know, which is synced to your, you know, home blood glucose monitoring, right? So the app records your blood sugar over a period of time whenever you've taken a test. Mm. And so she said that, look, they came and showed me a graph. And from that, I was able to understand that they have kept their sugar levels normal over the last 6 weeks.
Yeah.
So I was very happy because, so she was saying she was very happy to see that. Now, that brought an interesting question for discussion, and which I'll ask you also, right? So if doctors who are practicing today are going to see, you know, more and more patients like this who are using digital health technologies, who are using apps, they can no longer afford not to use those apps or not be familiar with it, right? Absolutely. So that is going to be a very interesting maybe choice for them, that among their busy schedules and among so many things that doctors do, maybe if they have to get familiar with such things in their own field, perhaps.
Yeah. No, that is the way forward. You cannot escape. You cannot escape without learning some of these things, how it is used.
There is inherent bias in humans. So for example, you know, so in US, in MIT, there was a study that was conducted and that showed that black women, younger women who came, and if they reported cardiovascular pain or ailments, they were more likely to get turned away because of some inherent bias, rather than, let's say, even black men. Or the best case was for white men in this MIT study. So somewhere we see that, you know, whatever. And in fact, I was speaking to another person who does a lot of transplants, liver transplants and kidney transplants. He was saying that in India, for example, there is a bias towards, if somebody has to get a transplant, it may be a male child rather than a female child. You know, it may, you know, if there was a choice. So interestingly, I mean, these are societal biases, but they do creep into even these apps, right? So how, in terms of ethics concerns, medical ethics and these kind of concerns, how do you see this? And how important do you think is for your students of tomorrow to know about such things? And have you dealt with any of these in your experience? Yeah.
Again, an excellent question. Medical ethics is a huge subject. And we introduce medical ethics now. The present new curriculum of MBBS also introduces the ATCOM, Attitude, Ethics, and Communication, as a module, which runs through from the first to the final year. Mm-hmm. See, the way this is approached, at least in our institution, is we do give case scenarios, like the way you said, that here is a patient who wants his father to have a kidney transplant. And then he finds that there is no real relative donor that is available for him. So he goes around saying that I'll pay this much amount for this much amount, anybody can give. So that type of advertorial happens in the paper. And then we would post this type of case scenarios to students, and they will go and read all the relevant material. From the literature, in terms of what is the Organ Transplantation Act, what is the allowed things, what are the things that are not allowed, what is it that this fellow did right, what it did wrong. So we do engage them in such type of discussions on ethical issues. Ultimately, the broad principles of ethics, like non-maleficence, don't do no harm, that should be primary in the doctor's mind. Then beneficence, you must always calculate the risk versus benefit ratio for any treatment option that you are offering. This should be at the back of your mind, constantly working. Then justice. Now this is where justice and equanimity, These are two ethical principles. Now, to the question that you said, once you apply equanimity, how can race, color, creed, or anything come into the picture? It should not.
Right.
It still happens. See, no, it's never an idealistic world. So sure. You're going to have some people who don't understand this. But once you stress this during early medical education into the student's mind, I think these people generally carry it throughout their life. So then the thing gets sorted out.
I think, so like you said in your education today, it's more like if, like you said, if more and more apps are going to be there, the medical professionals of tomorrow, I think probably they need to evaluate the outputs of those apps. So, for example, if the app says, yes, based on these factors, this treatment is not required for this person or treatment is required for this person. If I think the students who will become professionals of tomorrow will also have to evaluate it from the lens of ethics.
Correct.
Because technology, just like people, is also susceptible to ethics. You know, so there could be, wrong ethical decisions that may come out of an app that they are using.
Correct. Absolutely. Now, this is what we need to take care. And even, you see many of these apps standard conditions like I agree to the terms conditions.
Right.
Now, those will have 101 clauses to protect them legally. But then you must literally mean every word of what is written there. And must spend time, give time for the patients also to look at it and then take it up. But these are very interesting points that we need to really elaborate and talk about in terms of medical ethics and medical. And the other aspect is medical tourism. Now, that is another area where these apps will be of great help. See, like somebody who is wanting a heart transplant done, I'm sure the app should be able to provide transplants outcomes across the world if he has all the money. So he can choose the appropriate place and the appropriate surgeon.
Sure. So, Doctor, I think thank you for your insights. We talked about a number of topics in our discussion so far.
And a stage will come. See, this is the difference between US and probably India is, in India, every doctor will say, in my 40 years of experience, but in the US, the doctor will say, the literature quotes that if 100 patients are treated like this, this is what happens. See, that is the approach that I would like an Indian doctor or an Indian student to actually be talking about. Mm. Rather than saying, in my experience, your experience is one man's experience. What is the experience of, so many,
True, and I think that is going to be challenged because... there was a paper I read from Stanford where, they were using AI to detect skin cancer, skin lesions and all that. See, they were saying that, let's say a board certified dermatologist in his lifetime, how many cases is he going to see? Maybe pick some X number of thousands, maybe 5,000, 6,000, 10,000. Mm. Now, here was an AI agent that had looked at millions of scans in a data set. And based on that, it was telling you whether what it was seeing was likely, a skin lesion that was benign or that would be cancerous. So to your point, right, this whole point of in my experience, I think that is going to be challenged a lot with AI coming in because it can be trained on so many years worth of data and it's going to give you a result based on that.
Yeah.
I think that's some of the points that you've mentioned, I think we can touch upon it again. You mentioned about empathy and compassion. So luckily, I think AI is not there to provide those parts.
Correct. Yeah. Even that, you must see that robo cinema.
Yeah.
Where they have tried to introduce even that component. Yeah.
Yeah. But I think as you rightly said earlier, the empathy, the compassion, the human touch, I think these are going to be, they have been important. They are probably going to be even more important, for the medical professionals of tomorrow.
Yeah.
Okay, that's good. So thank you, Doctor. I think it was most interesting to talk to you and get your insights on healthcare and artificial intelligence. I think there were a lot of takeaways for me as well as for our audience. I once again thank you for your time and your valuable insights.
Thank you very much, Prasad.
Thank you, folks, for listening in. Do give this podcast the best rating you can in your favorite podcast app. Do connect with me, Ranga Prasad Sampath, on LinkedIn and follow my online handle, U+AI on Twitter, SoundCloud, YouTube, and Medium. I'll see you soon with the next episode. Enjoy.